This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
It was March 7th, 1964.
Betty Hill, 44, sat in the office of Dr. Benjamin Simon, a psychiatrist and an expert in hypnosis.
Betty had been placed in a hypnotized state. Her head and shoulders were slumped forward.
Her hair was permed, her makeup sensible and complimentary. She wore a knee-length skirt and white jacket. A look of concern permeated her features. She looked like she was in pain.
But she was merely under the doctor's spell. Dr. Simon asked Betty to recall a trip to Montreal that she had taken with her husband, Barney, nearly 3 years earlier.
She walked the doctor through their trip, how they encountered many French-speaking Canadians and had difficulty getting directions, how she struggled to communicate with a waitress over her lunch order.
Eventually, her story arrived at the night of September 19, 1961, as they returned home to New Hampshire through the White Mountains.
Betty described seeing a cigar-shaped object in the sky, flashing an array of unusual colors.
The object followed Barney and Betty. They stopped many times to try and get a better look.
Finally, the object passed so close to their car that they could see details. It was a saucer, larger than anything Betty had ever seen. And through an opening in the front of the saucer, something was watching them. Are we alone? Have we been alone? Will we be alone? Stories of alien visitation have been ingrained in human history. Alien life may not be confirmed, but our obsession with it can't be ignored.
Welcome to Extraterrestrial on the Parcast Network. Every Tuesday, we visit the marvelous and strange stories about our encounters with beings from another world and discuss how much validity there are to these stories. I'm Bill.
And I'm Tim. Today, we're continuing our discussion on the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill, two Americans who claimed to have been accosted by a UFO as they were driving home one night in 1961.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
Last episode, we followed Barney and Betty Hill of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as they encountered a strange object in the skies above the White Mountains of their home state.
They claimed that the object followed them and that there were mysterious figures within. Even stranger, Barney and Betty claimed that they had lost all memory of a 2-hour period of the trip.
Once home, they experienced intense anxiety. They found that Betty's dress was stained. Barney's shoes were scuffed. After a time, Betty began to have strange dreams.
Barney started seeing a therapist, and eventually, The therapist arranged for both Barney and Betty to see Dr. Benjamin Simon, a psychiatrist who would use his skill with hypnosis to help the couple recall what had happened in that missing 2-hour window.
Barney's first full session with Dr. Simon revealed a horrific tale of alien abduction and torture.
In this episode, we'll explore Betty's first session, as well as subsequent sessions with both Barney and Betty.
We'll follow the couple as their story becomes public and they encounter both allies and skeptics. Ultimately, we'll decide whether the Hill story is fictional or if they really were abducted by extraterrestrials.
Betty was still slumped in Dr. Simon's chair, deep under hypnosis.
Her breathing increased, her face contorted with fear. She didn't want to remember. Afterwards, Dr. Simon would command Betty to forget everything she uncovered in the session. This way, she wouldn't be traumatized by waking up and remembering everything all at once.
But now, while she was under, he wanted to hear what she had experienced that night in 1961. Dr. Simon assured her that she was safe, that nothing could harm her in his office. He commanded her to continue.
Betty returned in her mind to the night of the abduction. She was in a state somewhere between a memory and a dream, reliving everything in detail, but at a distance, as if watching a movie. She sat in her car, afraid, clutching her dog, Delcy. Barney had wandered off, chasing the UFO into a field. She waited and waited.
Her fears were replaced with fresh concern as Barney burst back into view, a look of shock on his face.
Barney threw his binoculars into the back of the vehicle. He didn't waste a moment getting the car into motion. Betty tried to get him to explain what was the matter. He wasn't making any sense. He kept saying, "They're going to capture us."
When the couple began their return trip through the White Mountains, it was Betty who first spotted the light in the sky. Barney was skeptical, and she could barely get him to glance upward. Now it was he who urged her to keep an eye out.
"They're above us," exclaimed Barney. Betty didn't think she could see anything, but then a strange series of beeps came from the back of the car.
Seated in Dr. Simon's office, Betty began to weep. When the doctor asked her why, she said it was because she was afraid. "Afraid of what?" the doctor asked.
"Afraid of the men in the road," she replied.
As the couple continued down the highway, they suddenly became aware of a bright red light blocking their way.
From the light emerged the silhouettes of men approaching their vehicle. Betty felt not afraid, but curious, knowing that something important was happening.
But Barney saw a dirt road leading off of the highway, and he rapidly turned the car in that direction.
The forest loomed over them.
Each turn threatened a new surprise, and before long, the road delivered. There were the mysterious men again, blocking their path.
Barney slammed on the brakes, and the car came to a sudden halt.
In the office, Betty continued to cry. Dr. Simon assured her that she was safe, that she could remember.
Her dread grew as the men approached the car. They split into groups, covering both doors.
Betty looked to Barney, but received no glance in return. His eyes were completely closed. He seemed to be not asleep, but lost, trapped in his own mind. The doors opened, and the small men led them from their car.
For Betty, too, the situation became hazy, confusing. She would open her eyes and catch glimpses of the forest, of Barney being led along.
It frustrated her that Barney could offer her no protection from these strangers. Why had he capitulated so easily?
It was then that she noticed the man leading her along for the first time. He was short, very short, and his eyes were unlike any she had seen before.
As she complained about her treatment and implored Barney to wake up, the short man spoke, admonishing her. He said the couple would come to no harm, but that the aliens had to work quickly, so she should cooperate.
She became aware of where they were taking her. There, in a clearing, was the UFO. Now at rest, it had the same unmistakable luminescent quality it had while airborne. It was indeed a wide disc and had a ramp extending below for entry.
Seated in Dr. Simon's chair, Betty's body relaxed. The tears stopped. Her fear subsided as her sense of curiosity took over.
The aliens were matter of fact. Aboard their vessel, they led the couple down a corridor towards separate rooms. They explained once again that they had little time, and so the two would need to be examined separately.
Perhaps due to some mental manipulation, Betty did not fight back against the aliens. She didn't even question the indignity of being examined without her consent.
She was led to a simple room where she was seated on a metal stool. An alien that Betty describes as the examiner entered and began running a series of tests. He scraped her skin, clipped her fingernails, checked her eyes and throat.
The aliens used strange wand-type devices to examine every inch of her skull.
Traveling down her body, they checked her arms and legs. They asked her to rotate so that they could examine her from additional angles.
Despite herself, Betty was beginning to find the entire process somewhat enjoyable. She even sassed the aliens a bit, saying that they were so interested in her nerves, but what gave them the nerve to kidnap her like this?
She almost didn't notice when the examiner appeared with a needle bigger than any she had ever seen.
She asked what they were going to do with it. They told her not to worry, that it wouldn't hurt.
Betty protested. She said she didn't want the needle inside of her. In Dr. Simon's office, she once more began to cry.
Dr. Simon allowed Betty to continue to remember as she clutched her navel, the sobs coming out incredibly rapidly. "It hurts, it hurts, it hurts," she cried. "Take it out!"
Back in her mind, she saw a hand reach out, waving over her abdomen. The pain disappeared immediately. She felt at ease.
Looking up, she saw a new alien, one that stood out from the others.
He was taller and he wore a cap, not dissimilar from a German World War II officer.
He helped Betty to sit up, ushering the other aliens from the room. The examination seemed to be over. After a beat, Betty spoke to him, saying that no one would believe this had happened to her.
The alien, who Betty would come to identify as the leader, actually smiled. He asked her what she knew of the cosmos. She replied that she only knew of the solar system and had seen a few pictures of distant stars.
Moving to the wall, the leader pressed a button, opening a panel. He removed a rolled-up map, spreading it out on the table where Betty had been examined.
It was a map of the stars, showing routes between them. The leader explained that some of these were trade routes, others were less traveled paths, and some were expeditions.
Betty asked the leader where his species came from. In response, he asked her if she could point out Earth on the map.
When Betty was unable to, the leader said, "If you don't know where you are, then there isn't any point of my telling where I am from."
Just then, the alien that had examined Betty returned to the room. He stalked toward Betty, abruptly grabbing her by the jaw.
He forced his fingers into her mouth, beginning to pull at her teeth.
She tried to protest, but the examiner persisted.
Eventually, he stopped. Looking at Betty, the examiner asks why Barney's teeth came out, but hers didn't.
In her chair in Dr. Simon's office, Betty actually laughed for the first time.
Back in her mind, she explained to the aliens that Barney's teeth had been knocked loose by a concussive blast in World War II. He had dentures, whereas she still had her original teeth.
"What are dentures?" the alien asked.
She tried her best to explain, but this only led to a further rabbit hole of questions. What is old age? What is a year? What is a vegetable? What is yellow?
Clearly, the aliens were operating in a very different world from humans. The aliens walked Betty back to her car, where she found that Barney was already inside, his eyes still closed.
The leader suggested that Betty watch them leave. He apologized for frightening her. She said that while she had been afraid at first, ultimately the experience had been extraordinary.
As the alien left, Betty opened the car door, waking Barney and leading him out into the road. She smiled, saying to Barney, "Come on out and watch them leave."
They squinted their eyes, their hair and clothes whipping around them.
The object, no bigger than a star in the sky just a few hours ago, now roared to life above them, glowing bright red.
Once it had gone, they returned to their car, getting inside. Betty spoke excitedly to Barney. She couldn't believe they'd encountered actual aliens.
She was stopped mid-thought as a beeping noise came from behind the vehicle. It was like radio static mixed with Morse code. It was the same noise they had heard right before the aliens appeared.
Both Barney and Betty began to grow sleepy again. They were falling into a trance and forgetting everything that had transpired.
Coming up, we'll investigate whether or not the Hills truly had their memories wiped clean.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And now, back to the story.
Dr. Benjamin Simon ended each hypnosis session with the Hills by commanding them not to remember anything of the abduction after they awoke from being under hypnosis.
This served the dual purpose of preventing them from becoming traumatized by their blocked memories and of keeping them from sharing their stories and potentially influencing one another's recollection.
Simon was not convinced that the abduction story was true. Yes, both Barney and Betty had managed to produce a similar version of the story separately and while under hypnosis.
And clearly, the emotions connected to the story were real. Barney had screamed in fear. Betty wept.
But Simon knew that even under hypnosis, memories could be faked. They could be images drawn from Betty's dreams or delusions brought on by Barney's war history and experiences with discrimination.
Over the next few weeks, and then months, Dr. Simon would continue to meet with the Hills and place them under hypnosis.
He carefully tested each of their stories and worked to try and punch holes in their veracity.
Dr. Simon had to be careful while attempting this. Hypnotized patients are extremely suggestible. He didn't want to plant anything in their heads that wasn't true.
An interesting revelation came about during Barney's session on March 21, 1964. This was roughly a month into the couple's work with Dr. Simon.
Dr. Simon questioned Barney rather pointedly. He asked, "From whom did you learn about this experience? You didn't really have it, did you?"
After a little more back and forth, Barney curiously replied, "Betty."
Simon pressed further, and Barney went on to say that in September 1961, Betty began to have strange dreams about a week after the abduction. Later, in October of that year, she told UFO researcher Walter Webb details from her dreams, and Barney had overheard all of it. This included the scene from her hypnosis recollection with the needle going into her navel.
She had shared the part about the dentures as well. The Hills had met with Webb in October 1961, 2.5 years before they began working with Dr. Simon. They weren't supposed to have been able to remember the abduction itself at that point.
If Betty could recall these details so early on, then why did she act as if she had absolutely no memory of the incident until being hypnotized in January 1964?
There is no reason to expect that Betty's story told under hypnosis was anything more than Betty simply resynthesizing her dreams. Dreams can be based on memory, but they can also be complete fantasy.
Despite this admission, Barney still swore under hypnosis that his own memories were not placed by Betty or based on her dreams. He claimed that his tale of being taken aboard the UFO and having his genitals experimented on was true.
Barney would not budge on this, despite repeated questioning. But Dr. Simon had now found a major reason to doubt the couple's story. The modern-day Hypnosis Motivation Institute, an American organization of accredited practicing hypnotherapists, suggests that hypnotists cannot force anyone to tell the truth.
As stated in our previous episode, hypnosis only helps to strip away counterproductive emotions that are unhelpful to the patient. It is not mind control. And so, while those under hypnosis are suggestible, they are still capable of maintaining lies or believing in delusion. Claims made while under hypnosis are not infallible.
Dr. Simon wondered why the couple seemed to remember the events leading up to the abduction, but not the abduction itself. If they had experienced a trauma, wouldn't the whole memory be blacked out? And if it were a delusion, wouldn't they conversely remember the whole thing?
Ultimately, Dr. Simon felt that the discussion of Betty's dreams prior to the hypnosis had influenced both patients. He also felt that the pressures of being an interracial couple in a secluded area in the 1960s may have contributed to the formation of a delusion.
Again, both Barney and Betty denied this while under hypnosis, but at the same time, they could both provide examples from the trip where race had come into play. For example, as mentioned in the last episode, Barney had been worried that some young people in a diner they visited were going to give them a hard time for being an interracial couple.
Dr. Simon's final session with the Hills was on June 27, 1964, 6 months after they began. He had allowed both Barney and Betty to remember everything from the sessions. He sat with them and played back the recordings as well. Both were deeply moved by what they heard. They felt that their testimonies while under hypnosis confirmed that they had been abducted.
Betty was able to recreate the star map that the leader had showed her. It featured about 20 stars connected by a random collection of complete and dotted lines. She was surprised to realize how much it resembled a constellation, though not one that she could recognize.
Barney began working during the day and closer to home. His anxiety subsided, his ulcer disappeared.
Though Dr. Simon and the Hills had come to different conclusions, the ultimate result was a positive one. They were at peace with the incident.
They told Dr. Simon that they planned to get back to life as usual. And yet, soon the couple would be thrust onto a national stage beyond anything they could have expected.
The couple's initial foray into the spotlight was not through their own actions. In October 1965, the Boston Traveler, a New England newspaper, published an unauthorized account of the Hills' story.
The writer had sourced UFO experts that the Hills had spoken with, as well as a tape recording from a social gathering where they had shared their story.
Frustrated by the thought of someone else reporting on the incident, the Hills contacted John G. Fuller. Fuller was a UFO writer then living in nearby Exeter, New Hampshire. He had moved there to write a book on a UFO incident that had taken place in that town a few months earlier in September 1965.
His previous works, which recounted UFO sightings without skepticism, appealed to Betty. Later that year, he agreed to work with the Hills and Dr. Simon to publish the complete story of the abduction of Barney and Betty Hill.
The resulting book was titled The Interrupted Journey and released the following year in 1966. It sparked even greater public interest in the Hills' story and made them minor national celebrities.
In the foreword to the book, Fuller writes that, quote, "The Hills had sat on this story for nearly 5 years. They were not seeking publicity."
This is slightly misleading. Though the White Mountains incident had taken place roughly 5 years prior in 1961, the Hills supposedly had only just become aware of the full story a year prior through the hypnosis sessions with Dr. Simon.
Not to mention, they had shared with various friends, family, UFO researchers, and church groups. From the moment she had returned home from the mountains in 1961, Betty had wanted to share her story. And now she would get the chance to do so on a national stage.
In May 1966, both Barney and Betty would be interviewed on the Alan Douglas Show, a Cleveland area radio program. At this point, they discussed the full details of the abduction, including what they had learned under hypnosis.
The host of the show seemed to take their story very seriously. Barney is uncharacteristically excited to discuss the abduction and willing to share details. He openly analyzes and theorizes about the aliens.
It's certainly a change from the man who 5 years prior didn't want to admit anything had happened at all.
Barney would next appear on The Mike Douglas Show in October 1966. That television program, hosted by Mike Douglas, not to be confused with radio host Alan Douglas, was nationally syndicated.
And again, Barney had no reservations about sharing his story in full.
The Hills would continue to undertake various radio and television appearances.
Their story became well known in the United States, and by 1968, the story had attracted the attention of Marjorie Fish, an elementary school teacher from Ohio.
Fish was inspired by Betty's star map, which she believed to be an authentic map of inhabited star systems and the supposed travel routes in between them.
Using modern star charts available at the time, Fish was able to identify each star on Betty's map. A star map is unlike a regular map in that a star map must exist in three dimensions.
Once she identified the stars on the map, Marjorie Fish believed that they represented a view of the Earth's extrasolar neighborhood as seen from the star Zeta Reticuli.
Fish would share her map with Betty, and in October 1968, the two appeared together at a Flying Saucer Investigations Committee meeting in Akron, Ohio.
But this would be Betty's last public appearance for some time. In February 1969, Barney passed away from a cerebral hemorrhage. He was 46, having lived only 8 years beyond the UFO incident. Though the hypnosis sessions had helped him to come to terms with what had happened, it's unlikely that he foresaw his life playing out in such a fashion.
And though there is no record of Betty's exact reaction to the loss, it appears to have been the one thing that could halt her UFO enthusiasm.
She wouldn't give another major interview until 1975, 6 years after Barney's death.
In October of that year, NBC released a TV movie based on the White Mountain story entitled The UFO Incident. It starred James Earl Jones as Barney and Estelle Parsons as Betty.
It was essentially an adaptation of The Interrupted Journey made with the cooperation of John Fuller and Betty Hill, as well as Dr. Simon.
After the release of the movie, Simon began a correspondence with UFO skeptic Philip J. Klass, an engineering and aviation journalist who had gained a reputation for debunking UFO sightings.
Klass had called into question Simon's involvement with the book and film, with Simon defending himself, stating that the film especially took liberties with the story, even depicting a dramatic episode in which Barney attempted to jump from the office window. Simon insisted that, although the movie might suggest otherwise, at no point had he been an advocate for the theory that the abduction had actually taken place.
It was surprising, then, that Dr. Simon agreed to promote the film, given that it seemed to cash in on the idea of the abduction having actually happened. On October 25, 1975, Dr. Simon appeared with Betty on The Today Show, an earlier incarnation of the NBC talk show that still exists today.
To appear on The Today Show at all with Betty expressed a certain tacit approval of the more outlandish aspects of her story. There would be no movie without the abduction, and there would have been no interest from The Today Show without the movie.
Despite this, both Dr. Simon and Philip J. Klass ultimately realized that they had come to the same conclusion. The Hills had seen something on their road trip that profoundly affected them.
It is of note that neither man ever felt that the Hills were outright liars. In fact, Philip J. Klass would, later in his career, suggest that he believed that the vast majority of UFO skeptics had indeed witnessed unexplained aerial phenomena.
He simply took issue with those who would jump to the conclusion that these strange lights or mysterious objects in the sky were definitely spacecraft from another world.
Betty, for her part, also began a correspondence with Klass. In a letter dated November 13, 1975, she made some fantastic claims.
She claimed that an investigator has received and investigated more than 350 landings in the last 5 years. If that were true, it would suggest a nationwide emergency of UFO phenomena.
She also claimed that she could pick up signals from UFOs on her radio at night.
They were bold claims backed up with no evidence, revealing Betty to be somewhat conspiracy-minded in her approach to studying UFOs. Klass responded respectfully, but he was obviously skeptical of each and every claim made by Betty. In his written reply, he asks Betty to provide the name and address of the aforementioned investigator.
He also asks her whether she had ever made a recording of the signals on her radio, or whether she had ever requested permission to sit in at the nearby Pease Air Force Base radar tower.
In her written replies, Betty appears incapable of addressing these specific inquiries. She claims that the radar reports from the night of the incident are lost to time. She goes on a tangent about how she always resented that Dr. Simon spent more time with Barney than her. And she criticizes a man named Robert Schaefer, who had published a theory suggesting that what Betty saw on the night of the incident was the planet Saturn, which would have been visible in the sky next to Jupiter.
Schaefer was in fact a colleague of Philip J. Klass. Both men were part of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, a nonprofit organization founded in 1976 with the goal of bringing scientific investigation to outlandish claims, such as those of UFO abduction.
By singling Schaefer out, Betty may have further provoked a man who would become her biggest critic. Schaefer, age 69 today in 2019, is a prolific author and skeptic known for debunking a wide variety of paranormal topics.
In fact, just a year later, in August 1976, Robert Schaefer would write an article that still stands as the most complete criticism of Betty's story to date.
Not only would Schaefer's article call Betty into question, but it would provide a plausible explanation as to what exactly Betty and Barney had seen in the sky that night in September 1961.
It would make a case for there being no aliens in the White Mountains at all. Coming up, we'll look into the details of this article. Now, back to the story. In August 1976, writer and paranormal skeptic Robert Schaefer published an article in the magazine Official UFO that challenged the famous story of the abduction of Barney and Betty Hill.
Though Barney died in 1969, Betty continued to make radio and television appearances, swearing by her story that she and Barney had been abducted by aliens in 1961. Schaefer took issue with this publicity and outlined four key points in his article.
First, he believed that Marjorie Fish's star map was unscientific. She ignored some of the stars on Betty's original map and ignored other stars in the extrasolar neighborhood of the Earth.
Second, Schaefer felt that Betty's oft-cited radar reports from Pease Air Force Base were easily explained. These were radar sightings from the night of the incident, basically a list of radar pings that suggested something approaching the runway at the base.
The sensitive radar often picks up animals. Even more damning, the radar in question is meant to pick up objects only within a half a mile of the base. If a UFO of the size that Betty describes were approaching, the observers at the base would have seen it.
Third, Schaefer questioned the accuracy of the Hills' memories. For one, weather reports from the night of September the 19th, 1961, show that the sky was mostly overcast. Both of the Hills maintained that the sky was clear.
Schaefer's fourth and final point came down to Betty's initial sighting of the light in the sky. According to his article, there were three lights in the sky that night: the moon, Jupiter, and Saturn.
His theory, therefore, was that the shifting cloud cover of the evening had moved, and Betty's eyes had suddenly been drawn to the bright appearance of Saturn, Jupiter, and the moon in formation.
As to why Barney and Betty then claimed that light followed them and abducted them? Well, Schaefer left that explanation to the likes of a psychiatrist such as Dr. Simon.
This compelling dissection of the Barney and Betty Hill mystery did not put an end to the matter. Betty baited Klass and Schaefer, going so far as to tell the former that she was working to telepathically send aliens to his home.
Throughout the 1970s and 80s, Betty would continue to give interviews, continue to participate in UFO research, and continue to try and seek out an explanation for what had happened to her.
Over time, her fame subsided. Her inability to approach the subject matter from a remotely scientific perspective made her less and less of an appealing guest for television.
And by the 1990s, UFOs were utterly mainstream, no longer a curiosity worthy of the Today Show. In 1993, American television creator Chris Carter would co-opt the stories of people like Barney and Betty Hill to create The X-Files, a fictional television series following FBI investigations into the paranormal. Alien abduction was now entertainment, not news.
In 1999, Betty gave a video interview to New England folklorist John Horrigan, in which she recounted the events of the abduction for what was surely the 100th time.
In the video, she has, of course, aged much since 1961. Though she is now 80 years old, her voice is easily recognizable from Dr. Simon's tapes of 1964.
She remains confident in her story, though some details have been added. When the aliens first remove her from her vehicle, she now punches one in the face.
She recalls the whole thing as if it were one of the happiest moments of her life.
Betty Hill passed away in 2004 at the age of 85. She remained in Portsmouth, New Hampshire her entire life, never remarrying after Barney's death.
UFO enthusiasts and skeptics alike continue to debate her story to this day.
Betty's niece remains a staunch advocate for her aunt's account, claiming that the debunkers overstate Barney's anxiety and misrepresent the facts of the trip.
Meanwhile, skeptics such as Robert Schaefer maintain online databases with case files debunking UFO sightings from throughout the years. They insist that science will always prove stories like the Hills to be false. Viewing the case from the perspective of 2019 provides additional insight that doesn't require a degree in astronomy. By examining the facts, we can rate the believability of this case on a scale of 1 to 10.
There is much to Betty's story that suggests she imagined the abduction. Betty excitedly shares that the aliens would ask her, "What is a vegetable?" or "What is yellow?"
This feels more like the quaint imaginings of a 1960s UFO enthusiast than the authentic questioning of intelligent beings from another world.
Indeed, modern science allows mankind to observe the universe with more ability than Betty suggests these interstellar travelers were capable of. For example, the Hubble Space Telescope, launched in 1990 by the United States National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, is capable of taking detailed photographs of objects over 5,500 light years away from the Earth.
Most recently, in November 2018, NASA placed the InSight robotic lander on the surface of Mars and has begun to model that planet's interior.
The launch of Russian satellite Sputnik in 1957 inspired great anxiety in the American people. They asked, what else might come from the stars?
But in 2019, with a greater understanding of the cosmos established, that question holds less terror, less uncertainty.
In addition to this, the reproductive imagery in Barney and Betty's story is a common element in dreams and delusions that result from trauma. It is primal, even mythic.
Human beings are highly advanced animals and are biologically programmed to be sensitive to their own weaknesses. This includes their genitalia and, for females, the womb.
Any experience that brings about intense fear or feelings of inferiority can cause a return to that primal fear of harm coming to these parts of the body.
Given the 5-year timeline of therapy and hypnosis following the incident, it seems most likely that a combination of UFO zeitgeist, racial paranoia, and an unexplained sighting in the mountains of New Hampshire led the couple to develop an intense anxiety that manifested itself as a belief that they had been abducted by aliens. With all this in mind, our final conclusion leads us to rate this a 3 on the believability scale.
While the abduction seems to be completely made up, the case deserves a few points for the simple fact that Barney and Betty were, by all accounts, a normal couple before the abduction. They just didn't seem the type of people who would make up such a tale or experience such a serious psychotic break.
Which means that there is a chance, however small, that there exists an alien species vastly different from humankind.
Which, in turn, means that there is a chance, however small, that the story of the abduction of Barney and Betty Hill is entirely true.
Thanks for listening to our story on the abduction of Barney and Betty Hill.
You can listen to Extraterrestrial and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week with a new episode.
Until then, don't forget to keep your eyes on the sky. Extraterrestrial was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler, Maggie Admire, and Carly Madden. Extraterrestrial is written by Greg Castro and stars Bill Thomas and Tim Johnson.